Brian O'Doherty is one of our most acclaimed artists living abroad. He has lived in the United States since the 1950s. In 1972, as a reaction to Bloody Sunday in Derry, Brian decided to exhibit his work under the name of Patrick Ireland, until, as he said, such time as the British military presence is removed from Northern Ireland. He has been a friend of some of the most important artists of the 20th century, including Edward Hopper, Mark Rothko and Marcel Duchamp. As this month is the birthday month of Edward Hopper, the great artist and creator of Nighthawks, we took the opportunity to ask Brian O'Doherty about his friend. However, as I met up with Brian at the Irish Museum of Modern Art, where he was giving a talk on the current exhibition of Hogarth etchings, I asked him first about Hogarth, the great social commentator of the 18th century, and asked Brian O'Doherty, is Hogarth still relevant today?
Yes, if you walk on the street, you'll see Hogarth characters. He's relevant. But as long as there is sin, he's relevant.
You also talked about the point of the great point in the understanding of art, where was it Duchamp who said that the audience completes the picture?
Yes, he did. He wrote this seminal essay in the 50s in which he made that point. It was sort of a surprise to many people. It's so obvious. But many times, the obvious is not said. And when it's said, people say, oh, of course I knew that.
But Hogarth was unique in the sense of the narrative, and you said that it was valid to have somebody interpret that narrative or actually to describe it for us.
That's right. Literary people love Hogarth because he paints for your ear. You listen to what's going on, and each is a text that you hear when you look at the picture. It's a fact that literary people, from Richardson to Henry Fielding, the first novelists, were deeply interested in Hogarth. And so was this German that I spoke about, George Lichtenberg, who was a friend of Goethe and wrote the fantastic Hogarth commentaries with great gusto and Germanic thoroughness.
The other point that picked up on the Hogarth thing was talking about his ability to manage the eye, where the eye was.
Yes, that's the composed variety that the 18th century made into an aesthetic, the Concordia Discourse. That is, how do they describe it? It was a harmony in a kind of chaos, a harmonious disorder, which became for Hogarth a guiding light, this composed variety, which led the eye around through the various intricacies of the painting, so that there's a hierarchy of looking. So where's the main focus? What's the secondary focus? Where do I go now? So each person finds their way through the picture in a kind of editorial sense. They edit the picture to their own attention. Interesting.
It is an interesting
way of doing things.
But then again, it's such a rich series of prints, are such a rich, there's so much detail in it, you could have a half an hour in any one of them.
Everything is calling. Everything is even the dogs are talking to you. Even the pictures up above, the people are making comments on the people. An overturned chair, this or that or the other. A sweet and unsweet disorder in the dress of the lady in the mariage à la mode. It's full of good observation that later became caricature with Gilray and Rowlandson, you know, but at this point it's we can relate more directly to it, because caricature is looking for political comment, as we know, God knows. It's looking for laughs, it's looking for exaggeration. But here, you know, he's presenting what passes for reality. If you saw it on the stage, or if you saw it in the real world with modern clothes. If you put all these people in modern clothes, you say, geez, I understand that. I've seen that. That's me cousin so-and-so. And that's it. You know? And that's I know that fellow with that bottle in his hand, you know. He's married to my sister's so-and-so, you know, all that sort of
but
stuff.
But that's why Hogarth is still relevant to us.
Well, I think so. I mean, as long as there is vice, and unless Dublin becomes vice-free, Hogarth will be relevant.
Last year you had a great retrospective at the Dublin City Gallery, Hugh Lane. Did you get a great response to that? Did you enjoy doing that?
Well, when you see 50 years of your life laid out on a stretcher, as it were, it's sobering. But people say, well, that's 50 years. What did you feel about 50 years? Well, to me, it felt like one long afternoon, because 50 years goes like that, doesn't it? Time telescopes, changes, alters as you pass through it. And the sweat and pain and joy and horror and delight of passing through it sort of disappear. And you just remember what's left, what's sifted through, what's left on the sieve, as it were. And so that was what was left on my sieve, all these works. And so I looked at them like a stranger very often. I said, looked at them, hey, this guy's not bad.
How do you look back now at Patrick Ireland? We have completed the peace process. We have devolved government in Northern Ireland. We have Ian Paisley sitting down with Martin McGuinness. Surely it's time for you now to renounce Patrick Ireland.
Porrick, it is time to bury Patrick. And I'm working on that. I'm working on a venue. He will be formally buried. There will be an effigy. There will be, as in political funerals. And this is serious stuff, because what we're burying is hate, along with Patrick. And it is time, you're very right, it is time to bury him. He is now 36 years old. He will be 37 next December. And so I'm working on that. And that will be a very important phase in my life, because I got very attached to Patrick. So I'll have to go back to Brian O'Doherty, because as you say, civil rights are fine. They got there. Things look good. The police force seems to be so far working. The guns are off the street. The tanks are off the street. So therefore, I have to fulfill the implications of my initial gesture. And so Patrick will be buried, and I'll give you full notice.
Where might you think he will be buried?
Oh, in Dublin. In Dublin. Dublin's my city.
And he will be buried. Do the eulogy? Brian O'Doherty, perhaps?
No, I have a very fine man who was a Jesuit, but is no longer a Jesuit, and he has agreed to officiate at the ceremony. This is serious stuff. As I say, you're burying hatred, and there are a few people I would like. You know, there are great orations over graves in Irish history. I remember Michael McLeamore reading O'Donovan Rossa's Paris Beer speech over the grave of O'Donovan Rossa, a great one, and Michael, bless his heart, did a great job on that. It made my hair stand up on end when I heard it first as a young man. So without blasphemy or trivializing, to me, the gesture was an important one when I became Patrick Ireland. As an expatriate, I couldn't become Patrick Ireland in Ireland. That would be kind of stupid, silly, and offensive. But as I'm over there, and all those years ago, in 1972, and there was nothing I could do. But my family were very involved in the revolution. The Brennans were, my uncle Paddy was involved in that, and so was the Brennan boys, the cousins. They were pretty well known in those days. So that sort of Republican thing was in my family. So the gesture I made was to take that name. Now I have to give it up, and I have to bury him and separate myself from him, who became a very real presence to me. And we hope to do it with dignity and to emphasize again and again that we're burying hatred and we are not trivializing anything at all.
But nonetheless, even in the most tragic of Irish burials, there has to be a wake, an occasion of some sort of celebration and party.
No, Patrick Ireland's wake will occur, believe you me.
We will look forward to that. Recently, at an exhibition in the Whitney, we heard you were talking about Edward Hopper. And you did a film, an award-winning film, when you worked with the National Endowment for the Arts on Edward Hopper.
Moonlit. I took time off to do the film. And it was premiered at the New York Film Festival. It was called Hopper's Silence. I knew Hopper very well, and his wife, as my wife did. We used to see them all the time. And I was very fond of the old man. His wife was a bit dicey. You can't say this now because feminists will have my life, but truth must be told, and she was a bit of a terror. I liked her, but she was very hard on him. But that's what wives are supposed to do, isn't it?
Well, let's look at that, the women in Hopper's painting. But going back to his painting style first.
Yes.
When he started off, people said, oh, this is realism. But nowadays, people don't see him as realism at all, do they?
Well, they see it as a journey through his characters into the mystery of his own identity. I asked him again and again, what does this mean? What is that? It's a real pain in the neck to him. And he said, it's about me, he'd always say. It's about me. And I had the sense that all these paintings were a kind of self-portrait, because they are, as you say, realism. What's realism? I don't know. But they are more than that. They are. He was a great somber poet, in my view. And the paintings are like freeze frames from a lifelong movie. which he investigated his own nature, which was always mysterious to him. I always had that sense. He was a big man. He was big as you. And he always, not to be quite fit in his own body, he always seemed to be wondering who he was. He was very intelligent. He had a great sense of humor. He was a lovely man, and there were lovely things about the wife. But it's only in recent years, really, that in the past 20 years, that Hopper is recognized for the extraordinary painter he is. And now he goes across every border, national, ethnic, everywhere. Sexual, men, women, everything. Everybody loves this guy. You take it to Japan, they're crazy about him, everywhere. It's extraordinary. What is that?
Well,
what is it in the paintings?
When you think of it like that, his first major exhibition was in 1933, in the middle of the Great Depression and the end of the American dream, a time of crisis and a time of sadness. And this is when his first major exhibition happened.
He hated to be seen as an American scene painter, but there was a whole desire on the part of critics and people at that time to call him American. He's an American. He's a great American. Hopper didn't like that at all. He's an artist, and he's a great artist. And so for many years, he was sort of bound into that cliché of an American artist, an American scene artist. And in fact, he was much more, and is much more. And thank God it's all working out. Of course, he's far not there to look at it. He's not there to see these prices. And they live very frugally, and they lived at times with difficulty, and the money wasn't there in any great excess. I think it's very painful for somebody like Van Gogh, if he came walking down Grafton Street and went up to the gallery and said, God, look what they paid for this. Artists generally who are very successful posthumously must be whirling in their graves at a great speed.
But going back to Hopper, he was a lonely guy. He suffered from depression. He was stayed in his own a little bit. And his characters... Are his characters based on himself? Like, all his characters seem lonely, detached.
Let me talk about that. There's a woman who wrote his biography, and she made hames of it in terms of who he was. She never knew him. Hopper was a great guy. He was funny, he was witty, he was delightful, he was extremely lovable. You know, I love the old guy. And he was, people have read in to this isolation business. It's very easy to say, oh, these characters are alone, they're alone in the city, they're isolated, therefore there's a depression, this and that and the other. I think being alone is a wonderful thing. You don't have to be lonely if you're alone, you're enjoying your own company. And as George Bernard Shaw said on one occasion when his hostess went up to him at a party and said, are you enjoying yourself, Mr. Shaw? And he said, madam, that's the only thing I'm enjoying. And so Hopper was enjoying himself. And as he said to me, the loneliness thing is overdone. He said that to me. But it's an easy way out for people.
But it's a way of getting into the paintings right away.
Well,
it's a way of reading it.
Yeah. I don't believe in it, though. I think that he's a much deeper poet than just dismissing him with isolation and depression. That is part of that malevolent bloody biography by that woman.
Well, let's go move on then to sex. His wife Josephine, once they got married, decided that nobody else would sit for him or pose for him. Is that correct?
She was a little possessive, yes. She was a little possessive, the little vixen.
And people suggest that there is a repressed sexuality in a lot of his work. A lot of the figures, the girl opposite at night, girl at the table.
Well, it started off as Joe, the wife. It started off as Joe, and then it got more and more sexy. And some of the girls are really tarty. And he did a wonderful one of the burlesque. You know the burlesque dancer? That's a terrific one. That started off as Joe, but she got a little loose as she got transformed. And I suppose you could say there is a degree of sexuality, whether he repressed it or not, I don't know. He's certainly expressing it there, wasn't he?
Mm.
And, I would generally, having known them, not subscribe to many of the things that are current commentary about him.
You mentioned your lecture earlier on about a suitable disagreement is always necessary for intellectual harmony.
Yes.
Was that the case between Hopper and his wife, Jo?
I think that's well said, because they seemed to be very close. There were times when I thought she was going to attack him. She had no sense of humor. That's a terrible thing in a woman and a man, God knows. She had no sense of humor. And so therefore he'd say something, and like some women, they would take offense. And so she'd start attacking him, and he'd look at me, and he'd wink. And so he had to put up with that. Imagine being married to a woman with no sense of humor. She'd never forgive you for anything, would she?
Certainly not. Going back to the influence of opera had, like, people look at the graphics of it, the figures sitting in the restaurant in Nighthawks, or the figures in the office, or the figures, but they don't actually look at the background, the colour, and his use of colour. That was very interesting at the time, wasn't it?
No, you're going on to something that's been ignored. And when we're talking about Hogarth, what you look at first, what you look at next, how you manage a picture, how you edit a picture like you read a text, you know. Well, Hopper's texts, if we call them that, figures and landscape, they're intimately bound to their environment, no doubt about it. They are part of their environment, and the environment speaks its own voice. And some of the painting is generally seen as a rather poorish painter by some of the most eminent critics in America, like Clement Greenberg, and indeed he often painted rather crudely. But some of his painting of light, and that's what he wanted to paint. He said, I want to paint light. I want to paint light on the side of a house. Some of his painting of light is deeply poetic and beautifully handled with brush stroke, lovely touch. So Hopper is full of contradictions, like every good person, full of contradictions, every good artist, every good writer. The contradictions are there. So you're right. The backgrounds are often as important as the figures. In the last painting, Sun in an Empty Room, he left out the figure entirely. And up in Truro, I was with him when he was painting that. And he said, I'm trying to find out what a room is like when there's nobody in it. Therefore, he's talking about the observer. Does it exist just because you see it? Does it still exist when you're not there? This sort of thing. So he's getting to that stuff, you know. And he was a deep man. He was deep, very deep. And a kind, deep, thoughtful, humorous gentleman.
Did he influence your work?
No. No. The work I was making when I was writing about Hopper, he would have detested. Yeah, he would have detested it. Because he was very censorious about poets, for instance, that he thought were trivializing poetry. He didn't like Coleridge's Kubla Khan. He thought that was rubbish. He liked Robert Frost. He liked Verlaine. He liked some of the symbolist poets. He was pretty definite in his likes and dislikes. That's how you build up your own edifice anyway, isn't it?
Did he come to see your work?
I would never show it to him. I'd never show it to him.
So it must have been quite a strange relationship. So you were very close, you were good friends, but... And you were making the film about him. Yeah. Did you actually get on film what you would get at dinner on Saturday night?
Got a little bit of it, yeah.
Because it's always a difficult thing to get them
to say that. She was on the film, too, and she revealed herself very clearly.
More? She revealed herself as?
Well, she did. God bless her. She did.
Patrick Ireland, Brian Doherty, thank you very much for being with us on the 11th Hour.
A great pleasure, Patrick. Great pleasure to be with you.